Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven, stay driven.
And welcome to the show, everybody. Sorry, I had a little technical difficulty there, but now I'm back and I can play around with the soundboard. That's what we wanted. Normally, you guys don't get to hear my voice so quickly, but I will return to you shortly. I would play more Metallica, but guys, it's time. It's time to talk about it. It's time to talk about the Sandman. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the myth of the Sandman, you may be familiar with the figure of the Sandman, a man who carries around a bag of dust, puts it in your eyes, and when you wake up in the morning, you've got that nasty little crust in the corner of your eye. Well, that's not how the story of the Sandman really goes, and today I'm going to tell you a little bit about where the story itself comes from. Now, we've got a little bit of ground to cover, so let's start back as far back as we can, to the beginning with it. So, the origin of the Sandman myth is traced back to Scandinavia and parts of northwestern Europe. However, it's thought that many of these stories come from literature later read by people from this part of the world, and that would be Greek literature, which is not really that much of a surprise. The Romans read Greek literature. The Germans, the French, the British, everybody that was anybody at any given time all read Greek literature. So we get the figure of Morpheus, and I do not mean the Matrix Morpheus. I do mean the god Morpheus. For those of you unfamiliar with Morpheus, Morpheus was the Greek god whose realm was the realm of dreams. Morpheus was, in fact, the god of dreams, the one god with the amazing ability of appearing in dreams of mortals in any form that he so desired. As his name implies, the Greek word morphe means form. He was the one who shaped the world of dreams, so he is actually the creator of dreams. Morpheus was the god responsible for the dreams of people. When in the arms of Morpheus, people would enjoy a very sound sleep, but would also see dreams about their future or even coming events. Morpheus was the dream messenger of gods, communicating the divine messages through images and stories created as dreams. Being the master of dreams, Morpheus had the ability to send images to the visions of people, to shape these images and give a form to the creatures that lived in dreams. Morpheus himself had a talent in mimicking any human in the dreams, and was able to take any form that he so desired. Ovid, the poet, wrote in his Metamorphoses, "King Sleep was father of 1,000 sons, indeed a tribe, and of them all, the one he chose was Morpheus, who had such skill in miming any human form at will. No other dream, O Nyro, Morpheus's brother, can match his artistry in counterfeiting men, their voice, their gait, their face, their moods, and two, he imitates their dress precisely, and the words they use most frequently, but he mimes only men." Morpheus is known by another name, and that is the god of many forms. He is referred to as the winged Morpheus as well. Now, when in his real form, Morpheus was said to have had wings on his back, then it was believed that he and his brothers were given wings by their uncle, Thanatos, the deity of death. Although some interpretations said that they were actually wing-born. Now, the legend says that Morpheus used his wings to not only reach those who needed help in their dreams, but also to carry his father, the wingless Hypnos, to the dream world in the caves when, in several occasions, he needed to be saved from Zeus's menace because Hypnos was kind of a pain in the buns. Now, this version also suggests that Hypnos was a pretty lazy deity and spent most of his time sleeping while his sons, Morpheus especially, did most of the work. Now, the family tree of Morpheus is pretty interesting. His father is Hypnos, the god of sleep, and as his name implies, he spends a lot of time sleeping. They are descendants of two eldritch entities known as Erebus and Nyx. Erebus is the god of the formless god, essentially, of darkness, shadows, and the realms of death and the other world and the netherworld, basically. His mother is Pasithea, goddess of relaxation and rest, and she is a descendant of Hera and Dionysus, which is an interesting combo. And then finally, his uncle is Thanatos, the god of death. He has a couple of brothers. One is Phobiter, who is the one who created the scary dreams. He is the personification of nightmares, taking the form of huge and scary animals in your dreams. So if you have very scary dreams, you can blame Phobiter, because that's what he does. Then we have Phantasus, who is the one that creating the fake and illusional dreams and has no animus form. And lastly, we have Ikelos. He was the one creating the true dreams, making them more realistic. Now, Morpheus was very protective of his entire family, and he had the perfect family for his deeds. His father, Hypnos, was the personification of sleep, seen both as god and a rather devilish figure in Greek mythology. His mother was the deity of hallucinations. His grandmother, Nyx, is the deity of night, and his uncle was the fearsome Thanatos, who brought people to their death. Now, Morpheus and his brother were called the Oneroi, which means the dreams. They were his ultimate assistants. Aeselus was responsible for the for creating realistic parts of the dreams, thus altering the perception of human beings and making it possible for them to, well, basically making it impossible for them to distinguish between dreams and fiction. Then we have his other brother, Phobiter, who was the creator of phobic or fearful dreams. And again, while last we have Phantasus, who created the unreal dreams, full of phantasms. What made Morpheus the biggest among his brothers was his ability to oversee the dreams of heroes and kings and influence the dreams of the gods themselves. Now, Morpheus created a realm of dreams called the Dream World. And the dream world of Morpheus was the place where his family lived. While shaping the dreams of mortals as he wished and visiting countless bedrooms, Morpheus slept in a cave full of poppy seeds. The mythical fact is maybe why morphine, known as morphium as well, opium-based medication for severe pain, borrowed its name from Morpheus. Now, the River of Forgetfulness, or the River Lethe, and the River of Oblivion were found in that world, highly protected by the gates under the supervision of two monsters that would easily materialize the fears of any uninvited visitors. The legends say that only the gods of Olympus were allowed in his family's home. It seems that Morpheus was one of the busiest gods, so he never it's never mentioned that he has a wife, or at least so as it was known in the Greek mythology we have our hands on, but some interpretations were ready to see him with Iris, the personification of the rainbow and messenger of the gods. Now, Morpheus is, again, thought to be the source of our story, the Sandman. Now, time itself has been rather kind to the Sandman, who in the more Western European, more westernized version of the Sandman, we get a mythical figure whose duty it is to lull children to sleep and provide them with sweet dreams. Most of us recall the Sandman of our collective childhoods as a gentle spirit guardian of sorts, but such a benevolent depiction is actually a far cry from, again, his rather terrifying origins, that being Morpheus. Now, most folklorists agree that the Sandman as a cultural construct can ultimately be traced again to the ancient Greeks, as I said, specifically borrowed from the pantheistic god Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, who emerged from the underworld each night to influence humans by way of prophetic nocturnal impressions. Now, in the imaginations of Northern and Central Europeans during the 1700s, Morpheus was transformed into something more befitting the Christian dichotomy of good versus evil. Now, Germans in particular saw the Sandman as a demonic figure. Of course, everything has to be kind of sweet. You know, as a historian of, as a young scholar of German history, I can tell you personally that most characters within German folklore tend to have a darker edge to them, and I'm okay with that. But Germans in particular saw the Sandman as a more demonic figure whose mythos extended to a kind of nightly reckoning. Children who fell under his spell and promptly went to sleep were judged as good and obedient children. But children who fought the effects of his magic dust risked a sentence of mutilation, a life of torturous nightmares, or even death. Now, folk tales such as those involving the Sandman were considered to be instructional, and parenting being what it was at the time, relating these tales was as close to coddling as it could get. Parents loved their children, and of course, as parents do now in many cases, but in a practical sense, children were a valuable source of free labor, and that could mean the difference for a family's survival. So ample rest was required to make it through a very difficult workday. When your children during this time had a lot rougher than we tend to have it now. You know, we take for granted a lot of the stuff we have access to. We don't have to. Most of us don't have to get up in the morning and, you know, plant some crops and go milk some cows. I mean, some people do. Most of the stuff got pretty good. And again, our job oftentimes is not a life or death situation. For many of these people who lived in a largely agrarian society, particularly the poor, you know, bringing in a good harvest could mean the difference between surviving a very cold winter or dying during it due to a lack of ample rest. Again, was required to make it through the difficult work days. So it wasn't long before exhausted parents began relying on tales of the Sandman as an effective lever in manipulating difficult sleepers. Children who doubted the veracity of their parents' warnings need only check the corners of their eyes each morning to uncover gritty proof of his nocturnal visits. Now, obviously, you get some matter and under your eyes sometimes when you sleep, but parents were using this as a sign that the Sandman had visited, and thus you should go to sleep when I tell you to. Now, by the year 1816, German novelist E.T.A. Hoffmann distilled these local folktales for his popular work Der Sandmann, solidifying the figure's terrifying depiction in a way that later fascinated philosopher and psychological scientist Sigmund Freud. Hoffmann writes of the Sandman in his work, "He is a wicked man who comes to children when they won't go to bed and throws a handful of sand in their eyes so that they start bleeding out from their heads. He puts their eyes in a bag and carries them to the moon to feed to his own children who sit in the nests up there. They have crooked beaks like owls and can pluck up the eyes of naughty human children." Now, you better thank your happy stars that your parents never told you that tale, my grandfather would tell me. Ah, but I digress. One noted folklorist from Harvard and Harvard professor Maria Totter says that the Sandman mirrors, in her opinion, the Sandman mirrors our ambivalence about children. She is the author of the annotated classic fairy tales, the annotated Hans Christian Andersen and the annotated Brothers Grimm. She says, on the one hand, we love and adore them, but we really love them best when they're asleep. Sorry about that. Now, as folklore made its way from Germany to the Netherlands over the next quarter century, Danish storytellers did what amounted to a colossal favor for countless generations of children by dispensing with the Sandman's gruesomeness. Now, chief among these eager revisionists was Hans Christian Andersen, the Danish children's author of morality tales that include The Little Mermaid, Thumbelina, and The Ugly Duckling. Now, in his retooling published in Fairy Tales Told for Children, this was published in 1842, by the way, Andersen realigned the Sandman closer to the god Morpheus, giving him a more congenial nature and even providing him with the name, with a different name, Ol Lukoj, translation, Old Shut-Eye. Now, Andersen, whose kinder, gentler Sandman was the version that Dutch settlers ultimately brought to the New World, and is more likely the figure you're more familiar with. Andersen was the first author of note to connect sleeping with storytelling, according to some scholars, and his Sandman drops the magic sand dust in favor of sweet milk, and his judgments result not in mutilation, but simply in the withholding of dreams. As Andersen describes them in his work, under each arm he carries an umbrella, one of them with pictures on the inside. He spreads over the good children, and then they dream the most beautiful stories the whole night. But the other umbrella has no pictures, and this he holds over the naughty children so that they sleep heavily and wake in the morning without having dreamed at all. Now, Anderson has had a profound influence on 19th century culture, which included the promotion of bedtime reading, especially with the rise of a domestic, more bourgeois class, particularly the rise of the middle class, an educated middle class, what the Germans refer to as the Bildungsbürgertum, or educated middle class. With the rise of this, we see the rise in consumerism, and we also see the rise, with the rise of this group, we see the rise of consumerism, and we see the rise of more educated families. And more educated families are going to have access to more literature, which they're going to be able to share with their children for future generations. And this allows us to further preserve and further pass on folklore and legends and tales and the like. Now, taken together, Anderson's Sandman has remained the definitive version, influencing scores of artists, their songwriters, scriptwriters for roughly 175 years. It's Anderson's Sandman that the Cordettes, who are 1950s era call girl, all girl singing group, imploring in their famous hit song, Mr. Sandman from 1954, Bring Me a Dream, Make Him the Cutest I've Ever Seen. It's Anderson Sandman who Roy Orbison reassures us to go to sleep, everything will be all right, in his song In Dreams in 1963. And it's Anderson's decidedly non-threatening Sandman that Disney Studios features as an unlikely hero in Rise of the Guardians in their film 2012. Now, it's been said that what's buried cannot remain so forever, and that may be even true for the mystical Sandman. We get Metallica's hit rock anthem Enter Sandman in 1991, which is a decidedly darker interpretation of the Sandman, in which we listen to the lyrics and they say things like "Sleep with one eye open, grip your pillow tight, exit light, enter night." Take my hand off to Never Never Land. All these interpretations of songs. And yes, I just spoke the words of Metallica on the show. So anybody that wants to stone me to death, bring it on, baby, because I am pumped this morning. So you look at, and I love Metallica. That's just me personally. But we see a shift to it back to, the darker variety. And then we get later graphic novelist Neil Gaiman's wildly popular Sandman series, as future depictions of the legendary night visitor have begun to move closer to his sublimely darker self. For those of you unfamiliar with Neil Gaiman's popular Sandman series, Gaiman has been pretty well noted as being a guy that's sort of almost a revivalist. He's been bringing a lot of light to a lot of old figures, old stories, folk tales, legends. He's the writer of American Gods, which has now become a very popular television series and a very popular novel, I might add. But he took this figure, the Sandman, and it's a comic book series he wrote, and it was published by DC Comics. It's got some great artists. But the main character of this comic is the Sandman. The Sandman is Dream, also known as Morpheus and other names, who is one of the seven endless. The other endless are destiny, death, despair, desire, delirium, and destruction. Now, the series is famous for Gaiman's trademark use of anthropomorphic personifications of various metaphysical entities, while also blending mythology and histories into its horror setting within the DC universe. Now, The Sandman is a story about stories and how Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, is captured and subsequently learns that sometimes change is inevitable. The Sandman was Vertigo's flagship title and is available as a series of 10 trade paperbacks, a recolored 5-volume absolute hardcover edition with slipcase and a black and white annotated edition is also available. Now, series is actually critically acclaimed, so this series actually demonstrates the staying power that the Sandman as a figure in mythology has had. It's one of the first few graphic novels ever to be on the New York Times bestseller list, along with Mouse, Watchmen, and The Dark Knight Returns. It was one of 5 graphic novels to make Entertainment Weekly's 100 Best Reads from 1983 to 2008, ranking in at number 46. And one Norman Mailer described the series as a comic strip for intellectuals. This is in an interview that he conducted with Entertainment Weekly. Now, the series is noted for having a large influence over the fantasy genre and graphic novel medium since then. There's been various film and television versions of Sandman that have been developed unsuccessfully, though, since the 1990s. And in a panel at the San Diego Comic-Con International in 2007, Gaiman remarked that he'd rather see no Sandman movie made than a bad Sandman movie. In 2013, Warner Brothers announced that David S. Goyer will be producing a film adaptation of the comic book series with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. But then it was dropped after Levitt left in 2016. And so it's still up in the air. This is the actual character. And it's sort of his journey and his dealings being sort of stuck. The Sandbook comic being sort of stuck in his world. Now, the Sandbook comic book series falls within the dark fantasy genre in a more contemporary and modern setting, and it's described by many, such as critics Mark Buxton, as a masterful tale that creates a movement of mature dark fantasy. Now, the comic book also falls into the genres of urban fantasy, epic fantasy, historical dramas, superhero literature, and is written as a metaphysical examination of the elements of fiction. In which Gaiman accomplished through the artistic use of unique anthropomorphic personifications of mythologies, legends, historical figures, and occult culture, making up most of the major and minor characters, as well as the plot device and even the settings of the stories. Now, in its earliest arcs, the Sandman mythos exists primarily in the DC universe, and as such, numerous DC characters, of course, make appearances or are mentioned, but later the series would reference the DC universe less often while continuing to exist in the same universe. It's also been the comic itself has also been described by others such as Hilary Goldstein as a book about the concept of dreams more so than the act of dreaming. But nonetheless, this series has been critically acclaimed. It's actually been incredibly successful. And so what an evolution of this character, but I want to revisit the old tale that we get in 1816, the old adaptation. It's important that we revisit this reimagining in Northern and Central Europe during the late 1700s of Morpheus, because this tells us a lot about why, more so than anything else, it tells us a lot about what these individuals who are crafting the story believe Sandman and how they're reimagining Morpheus is important because of the various religious movements that are taking place during this time. But before we get to that, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to take a commercial break. But before we can do that, I have got to tell you guys a little something about our proud new sponsor of Totally Driven Entertainment. Now, we've got a proud new sponsor here at Totally Driven. He's funny, he's wacky, he's crazy, and he's totally driven. So if you get the time, check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com. And I'm sure you guys will enjoy what you find. See you guys after the break. We revisit the recrafting of Morpheus.
I'm Black Man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black, my beer. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Before the break, we talked a little bit about the evolution of Morpheus. We kind of went through it a little bit quick, covered a lot of information, but I want to backtrack to the reimagining of Morpheus as a character and formation of this concept of the Sandman first before we talk more contemporary examples. And then we'll talk a little bit also about E.T.A. Hoffman's version of the Sandman. Now, if we look at Europe in the 1700s, we have a few movements that take place in the late 1600s to early 1700s. We, of course, have this struggle between scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, as well as the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. Now, you take a look at Europe during this period, this is a very tumultuous time. England during this time is one of the few countries that has sort of a strong government, ruled in large part by a parliament once James II is, of course, overthrown. Poland is dismembered by the end of the 1700s, while Sweden fades into the background. Prussia becomes gains an absolutist monarchy, much like France's, and soon after, Louis declares war on the Holy Roman Empire, but the empire manages to defend itself much better than it did during the 30 Years' War. Then we have the rise of Peter the Great of Russia, who makes a stand, dragging Russia by the hair into the modern and Western age, much to the resentment of the Russian nobility. Despite his successful reign, he is left without an heir after he has his son killed because he doubted his loyalty, and is only able to scribble "give it all" before he dies. Louis the 14th. His aggressive foreign policy forces Europe to ally against him three times and for two major wars. how we have the war, two major wars, the War of Spanish Succession, and then, of course, the 9 Years' War. At the same time, Louis is building the grandest palace in Europe that Prussia, Sweden, Russia, and many other countries attempt to outdo, and that is in Versailles, where they have the beautiful Hall of Mirrors. And then you see that, you know, there are various social struggles as well. You still have slaves as well as serfs struggling throughout Eastern and Western Europe. Peasants continue to struggle to make a living during this period, particularly for the next 200 years. They're still kind of at the mercy of noblemen. Nobles in France are provided with a glorious court to attend while slowly being drained of their political power through debt and excessive time spent with the king. And finally, the world has not such yet seen during this time the flourishing of pirates. Sir Henry Morgan and Jean Lafitte has existed in the golden age in this time as a golden age of piracy. So this is a very tumultuous time. This is the Enlightenment Age. It's also known as the Age of Reason. It's the name given to the period in Europe during and America during the 1700s when mankind was emerging from centuries of ignorance into a new age enlightened by reason, science, and respect for humanity. People of the Enlightenment were convinced that human reason could discover the natural laws of the universe, determine the natural rights of mankind, and thereby unending progress in knowledge, technical achievement, and moral values would be realized. This new way of thinking led to the development of a new religious thought known as deism, which we won't get into right now. Also, the development of concepts such as humanitarianism. But let's look at some of the major changes in Europe politically, socially, economically, and religiously, because they are all going to factor into the various retellings of Morpheus. And plus, you guys all get a bonus history lesson for the day. Look at you. You're going to learn something about Europe during the 1700s if it kills me. So politically, wars during the 1700s were most often fought within countries over succession to thrones rather than between countries, as I talked about already kind of briefly. Monarchies still often ruled during this period, but with less security than in early times. Kings actually had to be a little bit more careful. The English, of course, executed their king in 1642. The French executed their king and queen in 1793 and 1794, respectively, during the French Revolution, and other European monarchies soon began to fall by the wayside. Royal instability suggested insecurity of the social order over which the aristocracies had ruled. Now, economically, new trade between countries generated new wealth. The newly wealthy tradesmen and merchant class, or the Bildungsbürgertum, the rising middle class, demanded a share of the social and political power formerly held only by the nobility. As a result of this, as a result of the political and economic changes during the 18th century, there are major social changes as well, particularly in places such as Germany, France, and the Netherlands. Now, as well as Spain. Be important. I don't want to leave them out. Now, the former rigid class system based on inherited positions of nobility and wealth became far less secure. There were also major religious changes during the 1700s. There was a significant decline in church power and prestige, which resulted primarily from people no longer believing in God or daily involvement in their human affairs, or its daily God's daily involvement in their human affairs. But that's sort of a oversimplification. Mainly people had disassociated themselves from the church. And with various new movements and the religious wars, the rise of Protestantism and various other forms of and various other, you know, denominations that rise during this period and earlier periods, there was a lot of different options at this point. Once scientists discovered that had once been attributed to simply God, mankind began to supposedly fear God less, and as a result, religious obligations are no longer the primary concern of many people. Rather than focusing simply on God and church, people of the Enlightenment focused on man. We have guys, this is the time in which we have famous poets such as Alexander Pope arrive, and then later on into the 18th century, we recognize the interdependence of men on one another. Rather than agricultural society, the agricultural society prevalent during the previous period, the 1700s saw the development of cosmopolitan society. People began to live in cities, in clusters, and dependent on one another rather than living alone and being independent of one another, the importance of cooperation and mutual respect became obvious. Now, during this period, we see the pushbacks against this. People still did cling to religion during this period of time. It's important to note that just because church attendance may have slipped during this period in some places, it didn't completely go away. I mean, the church never really died. People still went to church. Just a large number of people stopped going. Now, why are all these movements important? Well, I mentioned earlier that in the reimaginings of Northern and Central Europeans, it was necessary to sort of get a rein on young children. Now, during the late 1700s, people were trying to emerge into that Bildungsbürgertum, that educated middle class, but not everybody was there yet. And those people that were still depending on, a more agrarian lifestyle, a more agrarian-based economy, people were still, this was still a largely, despite the rise of cosmopolitanism and the rise of a middle class, an educated middle class, this really only extended to people who were tradesmen and craftsmen. They were the ones that composed the middle class. People that were farmers, they were still farmers. They were still sort of caught where they were. Poor people, not everybody that was poor during this time was able to rise into the Bildungsbürgertum and become a member of this educated middle class. Not everybody could not everybody could rise above their station. It became easier, and society became a lot less stratified. But for those people still caught in the realm of repetition and still caught in the realm of being indentured to a lord or being, bound to the land as a means for survival, there was a necessity for the reinvention of old stories. There were still tellings of tales. And these poorer classes, these lower class people, oftentimes they weren't allowed into churches or near churches. It was all fine and good for lords and nobles to be charitable and to be kind to poor people, but more often than not, they were kind to poor people from a distance. They threw their spare change in the gutter and were kind of like, okay, bums, go on your way, like, get out of my sight, you lousy peasant, like, I'm trying to go to church and talk to God, like, I'm going to be charitable because I want to go to heaven, but you're still a smelly peasant and I don't want anything to do with you. You're nasty, you're gross, you probably got boils, I'm out of here. This is sort of the life that people were stuck in. People that study this period, they get really wrapped up in the Enlightenment. They get really wrapped up in the rise of the middle class that starts in the late 1700s and pushes on into the 1800s. But it's really not in some places, and really in the case of Germany, and in particular the Netherlands, Poland, Denmark, in these places, it's really not until the middle of the 1800s that people actually start rising from their station to become educated and to form a middle class. There is still a massive stratification. There are still landed aristocrats who, even though they're in debt up to their eyeballs to kings and provincial lords that are greater than themselves or even to the church, they're still sitting pretty and they're still maintaining a hold on a large swath of land, and they're still dictating every day to the poorer, less fortunate classes than themselves. After the French Revolution, things start to there's a massive shakeup in France, but it's still not quite there. And really, after the French Revolution, you see a real clampdown by a lot of nobles, particularly in the in what we now recognize as Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, and parts of Scandinavia. That scared the absolute crap out of a lot of these nobles, particularly. And also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that, Spain and Austria as well. The French Revolution terrified a lot of nobles because they saw kings. They saw a king get his head lopped off, and then the people just took over. And that gave rise to the to anarchism and eventually the rise of a dictator that we all know very well, and that's Napoleon. And so subsequently, they were less than stellar. It was a less than stellar time for a lot of nobles, and they were less than enthused about the entire scenario. So how does this relate then to this reimagining of Morpheus, and why is it important? Well, during this period, you still see a push for Christianity to still find its place. Now, while people are starting to dip back into the old books, the old writings, the church has been dipping back into old writings for years, into the old myths and legends for many, many years. And in many cases, they had deemed much of it as heresies, but they still saw value in learning Greek and learning these different languages and reading these stories, and they still told many of these stories, but with a Christian twist. It's like a Sprite, you know. It's like a lemon lime drink, It's just crazy. But that's not the point. They took these stories and they gave them a Christian bend. Now, in the 1700s, especially during the late 1700s, you see the rise of the Enlightenment. You see the rise of these different ideas, and there's a big pushback against this by many that are outside of this movement. You see the rise of people studying characters like Morpheus, studying the old Greek, studying the Iliad, studying the Odyssey, and there is a pushback by the church to retake these characters and rebrand them in a Christian version, so they could maintain an influence over people. So people were hearing these stories, but then they could say, oh, yeah, we got that same thing, but God and all that good stuff, woohoo, yeah, we got that. That's cool. Good versus evil, God versus the devil, it all works out in the end. So you see the church is still trying to attempt to sort of monopolize this good versus evil dichotomy. And in Germany, there's especially a struggle between the Enlightenment, and you see it also in England, but in Germany, there is a big struggle between the Enlightenment movement and the church. And Germans in particular, particularly rural Germans, who had always been very wishy-washy when it came to religion and folklore and how they intermingled them, there's always been a wishy-washiness in there where if you squint at it just right, if it sounds okay, sort of, kind of on paper, the Germans would take it and run with it. And in particular, Morpheus, When they attempt to sort of adapt him into this concept of the Sandman, he immediately becomes a demon, much like almost like Krampus, really. They take these stories of, imps and elves, and these things now become demons. They're demons, and this was an early practice when Christianity first breaks onto the scene, really, and spreads throughout Europe. You see a lot of nature spirits. You see a lot of old beliefs being written off as either, silly superstition, or that's just demons talking. You don't need to worry about that. Well, we used to go do this, and we used to talk to the spirits. Those aren't spirits. They're demons. But I always talk to my ancestors. No, those aren't your ancestors. They're demons. And so in this particular case, you have stories such as Morpheus, who is, sounds good on paper. He's the god of dreams. He inspires people. He gives them visions. Well, when you have the emergence of Christianity on the scene, it becomes very clear that God's the one who gives people visions, right? God's the voice in the burning bush. God is the one who is telling people what to do. He's the one leading the Israelites through, through the wilderness to the promised land. He's the one delivering prophecies to Ezekiel and Elijah and Moses. And so it becomes problematic when you have these other figures who are doing the same thing. So what do? Well, we just rebrand them. Well, no. Morpheus, he's not a god, He's sort of like a little helper. Yeah, he's a little helper for God. And what he does is he's a little imp demon guy, and he runs around, and he punishes bad children. There we go. Yeah, let's take that story and we're going to run with it. So in the late 1700s, you see a mass for Christianity to sort of reassert itself during this period. As people start to become a little bit more educated, there's still a big push for,
to cling to tradition. Yes, those characters exist, but they're really these characters. And this is why you see a rebranding of Morpheus into this different figure, this demonic figure whose mythos extends to a nightly reckoning. These different figures, no longer can they just be sort of, a character in a story. Because if people believe in them, then that takes away from their belief in, God and the church. And we've got to restore their faith in us. And how do we do that? Well, we just demonize everything that's not us. It's cool. It works as an entertaining story. But at the end of the day, it's very clear that in this repurposing and reforming of Morpheus during the 1700s, it's in direct response to the attempts by people who are starting to become more enlightened and more educated. It's an attempt to undercut them and push back and reclaim, these different literary figures and turn them into something that... So you look at the German version by E.T.A. Hoffmann, and it becomes a much scarier story. It becomes a much scarier story, at least in the context of this novelist. Now, I quoted E.T.A. Hoffmann in his novel Der Sandmann, the Sandman is no longer this, guy who shows up and puts a little sprinkle of fairy dust in your eye or gives you dreams and visions and inspires you in your sleep. No. Now he's a guy that comes into your house when your kid won't go to sleep, grabs a handful of sand and throws it in your eyes till your eyes start bleeding. Then he snatches your eyes out, puts them in a bag, carries them to the moon, and feeds them to his devil children who sit in a nest up there and have crooked beaks and are owl-like and pluck up the eyes of naughty human children. Now, obviously, we read this story and we're like, wow, that is absolutely terrifying. But it's also, it's sort of like a boogeyman story. You kind of think to yourself, well, that seems a little far-fetched and a little over the top. And to a degree, yes, it is meant to be a little over the top. But it's still such a blurred line. So when we look at stories like this, it's important sometimes that we do. And I know I gave you guys a lot of information to sort of package and sift through, and you were kind of like, where is this going? But it's important that we know the cultural context behind what's going on. There is so much going on in Europe at this time that you can't help but have to go into it a little bit at the very least. And believe you me, we've only touched on little bits and pieces of it. We could talk for days about the Enlightenment. We could talk for days about the impact of the French Revolution. I promise we won't. I swear we won't do it today. But when we look at this repurposing of this story by E.T.A. Hoffmann, this is coming from local folk tales that people are telling. How do they know about this story? They know about the story because they're hearing about it from church people. They're hearing about it from other people. So they know this story because people are, somebody was talking about Morpheus or somebody was talking about one of these interpretations of Morpheus. They took the story, they adapted it, and they changed it. And that's how they repurposed it. Now, E.T.A. Hoffmann, he took all of these stories he was hearing and put them all together. It's very interesting that we see a figure like the Sandman evolve to such a degree. Now, then once we look at Hans Christian Andersen, who's quite well known for taking a number of fairy tales and folklore figures and repurposing them to be a little bit more friendly. When you look at the stories of the Brothers Grimm, for example, Hans Christian Andersen took a lot of those stories as well and repurposed them for more easy consumption for children, I should say, a lot lighter, a lot airier than perhaps what people were quite accustomed to. For those of you unfamiliar with the Brothers Grimm, the Brothers Grimm were two individuals who together went about the countryside and collected folk tales and fairy tales and stories from the people of the countryside and compiled them into a massive collection. They were known as Der Brüder Grimm or Die Gebrüder Grimm. Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm were German academics and philologists, cultural researchers, if you will, and writers who collected and published folklore during the 19th century later. They were among the best-known collectors of folk tales, and they popularized traditional oral tales such as Cinderella, the Frog Prince, the Goose Girl, Hansel and Gretel, Rapunzel, Rumpelstiltskin, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, and Children's Household Tales, which was published in 1812. Now, important to note that 4 years later, in 1816, E.T.A. Hoffman took some of these same tales he was hearing and crafted his own sort of story, a spooky story, and that was, of course, its intention to be a scary story. But it's in 1842 that Hans Christian Andersen took a lot of these same fairy tales and crafted more positive figures, more lighthearted figures. But the Brothers Grimm spent a good deal of time collecting a lot of these same stories that we see. They started doing this, and they took a number of stories that they found and compiled them into a massive compendium, which you can still get today. I mean, you can still get it. They also created one of the very first dictionaries, at least within the German context. They have a huge bibliography in terms of the books that they created. Now, probably Kinder und Hausmärchen, or Children and Household Tales, which has seven editions between 1812 and 1857, is probably the one that you're most familiar with. And, of course, they did the German sagas. They redid the Edda. They did Poor Heinrich, Old German Forest, The Song of Hildebrand, Fairy Legends and Traditions of South Ireland. They did a large number of books. They even did a German dictionary, two volumes, which was published between 1852 and 1960, republished between those times. So, if you look, though, the Brothers Grimm did this massive compendium of stories, and among them were stories that you're probably quite well familiar with. These same stories were read by Hans Christian Andersen, who took these same tales, which were designed to be, coming-of-age stories and moral lessons from passed down from father to son and mother to daughter. You look at stories like these stories do have a moral lesson within them. That's what these original fairy tales were designed for. So you look at a character like the Sandman, and it's very clear that the Sandman is not meant to be, at least in the reimagining of him in the late 1700s, is not meant to be, a cutesy, lovely, fun character. No, he's supposed to show up at your house in the middle of the night, and if your little ass ain't in bed, he's going to pluck your eyes out and run off to the moon with him. He's supposed to teach you a lesson, and the lesson that he teaches you is obedience and respect for your parents. Much in the same manner, we can take a lot of these stories, and I'll give a couple of examples. But we take a lot of these stories, and they do teach a moral lesson. You look at The Little Mermaid. The Little Mermaid teaches a very valuable lesson, is not to covet, right? What does Ariel, the mermaid, do? She wants more than anything to, and there's a number of lessons that you can learn from The Little Mermaid, but we're going to stick with this one, covetousness. This idea that you're not grateful for what you've got. She is a princess in the ocean. Her father is king of all the sea, but she's not satisfied with this. She sees people walking on land and walking on legs, and she desires these things and gives up her own natural gifts and beauty to gain these things and sacrifices them. And to do this, she makes a deal with a hag, which she probably ought not do. But learns a very valuable lesson because the hag goes back on her word. And
of course, we needn't go into all the details. I mean, there is, of course, a number of adaptations of the story. But nonetheless, it teaches us a valuable lesson. These bad things happen to you when you don't listen to what, if you don't listen to those things that come before you. Learn from these stories, and you're going to do all right in life. And that was the goal with a lot of these fairy tales. You know, fairy tales were not just simply designed to put the kid to sleep. They're also designed as a warning to the kid. They taught life lessons. You look at stories such as Rapunzel. There's a lot of different undertones that exist within Rapunzel, or stories like Little Red Riding Hood. But you still learn very valuable lessons. In Little Red Riding Hood, we learn that Little Red Hood is told by her mother, you know, go stay on this path, go straight to Grandma's house, don't talk to strangers, stay away from the wolf, and go in there, and then come right back home. As soon as she sees the wolf, she talks to him, even though she's told by her mom not to talk to her. And what happens? She tells him where she is going. The wolf beats her there and eats her grandmother and then tries to eat Little Red Hood, all because she talked to strangers. Now, am I saying that if you talk to strangers, people you don't know, you're going to get eaten by a wolf or your grandmother's going to get eaten? Good grief, I hope not. But the story itself serves as a valuable lesson. The things that your parents tell you, they tell you for a reason, right? Your parents told you things when you were growing up, but now instead of using a clever story, they tell you, just don't do that. That's stupid. Don't do it. And the Sandman story is no different than these. The only real difference is that we've seen such an evolution of the character. And it's interesting that the Sandman has sort of returned back to its roots, if you will. It's come back almost full circle. It's gone to that point where it was sort of abstract and very, heightened. In the Greek context, where you have Morpheus, who is this multiple-formed and yet also formless god who controls the realm of dreams and influences gods and men and goddesses. He's the deliverer of prophecies. He is the inspiration of artists and singers and poets and the like and thinkers. And yet he is also the prophet. He is also a huge thorn in everybody's side. He's also the deliverer of bad dreams. He's the deliverer of bad tidings. He is the servant of death. He's also the servant of relaxation and rest and rejuvenation. In the Greek context, he encompasses all these rich themes. He then evolves. He morphs into this this other figure, this rather sinister figure. During a period of social and political struggle, he becomes a different sort of figure, a figure with more malicious intentions. He becomes an entity who preys on children who don't obey their parents, who snatches the very eyes from their heads and delivers them into the darkest, worst, most terrible, unending nightmares that one could ever have. He then changes again into a more moderate figure, into a more moderate, more cutesy figure, a figure who arrives at night to sprinkle bits of dust in your eye and either endow you with pleasant dreams or give you a long sleep with no dreams and no inspiration, and then evolves yet again into this amorphous being in a realm that is both his own creation and his own prison, encompassing a great number of themes, such as a struggle between various forces of darkness and light, enlightenment and ignorance, good and evil, bliss and torment. All these things encompassed within Neil Gaiman's version. He's sort of returning to form. And we now have that more, now in the more contemporary sense, the Sandman has become
you know, he's taken on some of all these characteristics that have sort of been developed over time. But he's become more or less much closer to the original Morpheus, I think, at least within the Greek context, than he was in the repurposing, before the repurposing, just before it. And so it's interesting how these stories stick with us for so long, and then eventually, slowly but surely, some of these stories, they find their way back home. They find their way where they were meant to be. And, you know, interestingly enough, and oddly enough, you take a story like The Sandman, and you think that, oh, well, I mean, you know, who cares? Why is this important? You know, what could be particularly relevant about this story? Well, the reason that this evolution, the evolution of this character is significant is because it shows us the ingenuity of not only our ancestors, but it also shows us that we're not so different from those who came before us. We take these old stories and we take the little kernels of them that we like and we repurpose them and we adapt them and they become something different. But that's just what our ancestors were doing. We're doing the exact same thing that they're doing. Although we're doing it because we think we know better or because we're trying to entertain ourselves. This evolution of this character is significant for multiple reasons. Number one, it ties us back to our ancestors. It shows us how much we've really got in common with them. It shows the universal nature of the human spirit and how closely tied we are to one another. Hundreds of years may pass, but we're still going to tell these stories. We're still going to be inspired. We're still going to tell a story. Hundreds of years may pass, but the character doesn't die. Number two, it not only ties us back to the past and shows us how much we've got in common with those who've come before us, but it demonstrates the staying power of human culture. It shows that human culture has an indelible mark on our world, and not just because it's populated by humans, but it shows the power of an idea and how hard it is to get rid of an idea. This idea morphed from Morpheus, quite literally, nice little play on words there, if I do say so myself. But it takes, but much like Morpheus's name suggests, the many forms in which his character has possessed over the years, over the centuries, through the myths of time, he remains a fixture within our culture. And it shows the staying power of our ideas, our inspiration, where we draw inspiration from. Whether we are subconsciously doing it or knowingly doing it, we're drawing from the wellspring of human inspiration. One might even say we're reaching into the realm of dreams themselves, to the realm of Morpheus himself, and pulling inspiration. So it demonstrates the staying power of the concepts that we as people develop. And then a third reason why this is significant, it gives us a stunning example of how a good character and a good story never dies. It just evolves. It just grows into something else. It shows us that there are certain tropes, certain things that will just never get old. They stand the tests of time, and it's a testament to the character of the Sandman and the original creators of the Sandman, the Greeks, who created the concept of Morpheus, and to the immense amount of thought and time that they invested into formulating and explaining their world and their universe. It demonstrates the power and the influence that Hellenism and Hellenistic culture has had throughout the ages. We need only look at the concept of democracy itself to have proof that the ancient Greek culture permeates into our own to this very day. They're going nowhere. Makes us, stories like this, stories of the Sandman, make us question how far we as people are really coming, at least from a cultural standpoint. And sure, you might say we've made many technological advancements, but at the end of the day, we're still telling a story that's been told for thousands of years. Excuse me. At the end of the day, we're still telling a story that we've been telling for thousands of years, and that is a an amazing occurrence, one that is hardly that has been replicated in numerous forms. And we won't go into the many, many examples that there are, not today, because we don't have the time for it today. But it's amazing that the Sandman could provide us with this much insight into the human psyche and also into the development and evolution of human culture. Because it just goes to show that if you tell a good enough story, it can last forever. It can stand the test of time. We look at stories such as the Iliad and the Odyssey, and these stories have been repurposed, retold, reimagined. They've been turned into films. They've been turned into comics. There's, you know, the Greek heroes have not died. And it's amazing that the Greeks came up with so many gods, so many goddesses, so many stories, so many heroes. And that was thousands of years ago. And you think that these people that came before us had any notion, any inkling of an idea that, you know, 2,000-3,000 years from now, we'd still be talking about the same thing? That's impressive. And we should marvel at that. That in and of itself, the fact that this has existed for so long in human culture and has been repurposed so many times, it validates the importance of studying history and the importance of studying human culture, because it keeps stories like this alive. As long as there are people looking into these stories and rereading these stories and trying to understand them, the stories will never die. They'll only be reimagined. I hope you guys have enjoyed the show today. Hope you guys took a lot away from the Sandman. I know that I certainly enjoyed researching it. I'm going to give you guys some things that you can go look at for stories, you know, and not just on the Sandman, but also, you know, on the fairy tales as well. I want to, first off, on the fairy tales, I do want to recommend the Brothers Grimm's collaborative work, Children's and Household Tales. That's the English version of it, and there are multiple versions of it. If you want to read it in German, just get Kinder und Hausmärchen. You can get it. It's been republished a number of times, and you can get it in English either way, I promise. Next on the list, I do want to recommend that you take a look at E.T.A. Hoffman's Der Sandman. And it has been translated. You can get a copy of it, The Sandman. You can get a copy of it. So it's totally possible to get your hands on one. I'd also recommend taking a look at Hans Christian Andersen's versions of tales. You can totally get your hands on any of the fairy tales that he's ever written. But I do want to definitely recommend Ernst Theodor Amadeus's Hoffman's Der Sandman, Der Sandman. He did a fantastic job with that. And it's still persists today. And that translates, of course, to The Sandman. For those of you unfamiliar with German, I would hope that that part is obvious. And lastly, if you want to take the time, you might want to take a look at vanwinkles.com, in which they take a look at a lot of cultural developments regarding sleep. Science, health, and culture in regarding the importance of sleep, how insomnia affects people. It's a good resource for the sleepless and for those who just love sleep. So take a look at that if you're interested in that. But that's all I've got for you guys today. And I really hope that you guys enjoyed the show. Again, it's always a pleasure to do the show. A couple of announcements before I let you all go. Don't forget to catch us at 9 a.m. Sunday, Straight Football Talk. We're going to be talking about all the trades, all of the NFL buzz that's going on right now with injuries, trades, the implications of the trades. I know Jay Ajayi went to the Eagles, and I'm sure the Eagles are absolutely ecstatic about that because they only had to give up a fourth-round draft pick. I mean, basically, that was the equivalent of just spitting in a bucket and handing it to them and saying, here you go, we'll take Jay Ajayi off your hands. So we're going to be talking about that on Sunday. We'll also talk about some of the most notable injuries. Of course, many of those of you who haven't heard, Zach Miller sustained a very severe injury and is battling to keep his leg. Thoughts, prayers, got to go out to him and his family. It's a shame when you see a guy go down like that, get hurt like that. And what a gruesome injury. But it also goes to show that anybody in the sport can get hurt at any time. And, you know, you definitely don't want to see that. It's always terrible when you see that happen. But we're going to be talking about fantasy football. We're going to be talking about our NFL playoff predictions and projections for all you fans out there. Will your team make it? We're going to talk about the chances. So come with questions on Sunday. That's Sunday, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern time. And you can catch us here with Totally Driven Entertainment. Guys, that's all I've got for you today. I appreciate you guys sticking with me for so long. If you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you all on Friday when we talk about the Pope Lick Monster. Enjoy the rest of your week.